Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hello, Gary.
Hey, Guy. How are you?
I'm all right. Muddling through. Now, this is very interesting. We're taking a bit of a turn here, aren't we? Because it's someone who's sort of...
You've always been a turn.
one of my turns. In fact, you can hear the turns outside as it's brightened. Yay! I'm here all week. Try the veal. Yes, someone who... Actually, more of a satirical comedian than a musician. In fact, not a musician, although he is quite a handy bass player.
He is a handy bass player, isn't he? I mean, how do you judge these levels of what's good in bass? I have no idea, you know? I mean, it's...
Yeah, I don't really know. heaven, far be it from me to cast the first stone.
I've been listening to his... it's a multi-character we're having on today, isn't it, really? It's, to be honest, it's not... one person. I feel like we're about to interview about 6 people.
Exactly. Yes, it's a series. It's a microwave podcast series.
And I am quite concerned that he doesn't, you know, get too vicious with us with Principal Skinner or something.
Yeah, he could. Yes, exactly.
I've been listening.
It's the children who are wrong.
I've been listening to his. His podcast radio show that he does, and the last one he did, he said the two words he dislikes the most are "Hey guys."
Right. So let's try not to say that. All right. I mean, he's actually very much like a Peter Cook sort of character, isn't he? He's sort of in the way he's because his podcast is very deep dive American politics.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and he's done stuff on Nixon and the Nixon tapes. Yeah. It's going to be interesting. Should we let it roll?
Yep. Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
This was great, guys. It's so great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Well, it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
You know, what people forget about Bowie is that he was such a kind man.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Harry.
Yes.
I guess you're not going to say hey guys to us, are you? Because I heard your radio show.
Hey guys. Thank you for listening. Good night. I'm a diehard radio guy, but I know that... I'm of a dwindling breed, so I had to acknowledge that there were other audio devices. The idea that people will have those smart speakers in their homes is just so ludicrous to me. Why don't you just invite the entire intelligence division of your local police department?
Oh, no, that's right. We've gone from people sort of worrying about being wiretapped to literally saying, hey, wiretap, what was that recipe?
Yeah. The historical oddity in all this is that the Internet of Things, so-called, which is the smart home, the whole concept, the whole product line was introduced for the first time 3 months after Edward Snowden made public how much surveillance we were already subjected
to. I've literally just listened to your podcast on that.
Yeah.
You took a very deep dive. It was brilliant.
Yeah, didn't you people hear what Edward Snowden said? Now you just want to put this stuff in your home voluntarily?
Yeah.
Imagine if Nixon had had Alexa.
Oh, my God. Well, he would have had a real love in his life. Oh, no. Come on.
And how is the show going? You do this thing called Le Show, which I think, to be absolutely honest, Harry, I wasn't aware of until just recently, and I've been listening to it. It's how do you write such vast amount of comedy in such a short space of time?
I got trained when I was in my 20s by doing a daily radio show with a group about making fun of the news, and deadlines are amazing things. You know, you think you got nothing, and all of a sudden, you know, you look at the clock and you go, I got to have something, and something comes.
Because you do used to you did a student newspaper as well before, didn't you?
I was a student.
You're very much of the kind of Peter Cook ilk, aren't you?
My God, what a compliment!
Yeah,
except for the alcoholism. pardon me, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, I mean, I grew up adoring Pete and Dud, so that's a huge compliment. I still have a 45 of Peter doing a character called the Misty Mr. Wistie. Or the Wisty Mr. Misty Mr. Wisty.
Was that the one who spoke like that?
The guy who actually
we then, what's extraordinary is a few years later we actually voted him prime minister, because it was literally it was John Major, right? It was no one had ever heard that voice before. Yeah. And then someone said, "My God, suddenly he's prime minister."
He's running with it. That was Pete as a solo artist, but I just adored their work and his work.
Yeah, because you started off in that doing sort of political satire, but and in a way that seems like, I don't know, that was an English history to that, you know, that was the week that was that what it was called, Guy?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of, the Peter Cook thing, the establishment club and all that, you know,
There was a guy in Los Angeles on the radio who played British comedy records every Sunday morning.
Oh, wow.
I was addicted to all that stuff.
That was public radio. Would that be
That was commercial radio.
Oh, okay. It was like a KCRW type thing.
No, he was on multiple different commercial stations.
Oh, okay.
He had a shop called the Continental Shop, where he sold the English version of Heinz baked beans and all that stuff for the expats. And so he advertised his own shop on the show. So it was not public radio, but the Goons were actually on NBC radio here for a little while. So, I mean, I really got a pretty good education in British comedy.
Because that's what's interesting for us is how many, especially through the Saturday Night Live, and I know you were with them for a bit, but so much of that crew were all Canadian. And it seems to me that because of that, they had the joint thing of British comedy was part of their, you know, it was on telly every night and on their radio time. So they had the joint thing. I never thought in LA you would have that.
I guess you'd call me, therefore, the epithet most feared down here, an honorary Canadian.
What are you kind of, you know, growing up in, what sort of culture is it in your house that is making, you know, your parents turn on that kind of a radio program?
Oh, they didn't turn that on. They turned on American stuff. They were both European immigrants, and they were addicted to American comedy, Jack Benny mainly, which was so remarkable that I ended up being on that show.
That's right. But at the age of what? How old were you? You were
7.
Yeah.
7. And I walked through that magic door.
How did it happen? Go on, tell us.
Well, you have a keyboard in your shot. I was made to take piano lessons starting at the age of 4. And my piano teacher was a woman named Hazel McMillan. And her daughter was an actress, a child actor, well, a teenage actress at that point. And a couple of years into teaching me, Hazel McMillan decided to change careers. So she decided to become a representative for child actors, an agent. And she called my parents and said, "Do you mind if I try to get Harry some work?" And they went, as I said, European immigrants. They went, "Okay, I guess so." And 8 months went by and we heard nothing from her. And then she called with an audition for the Jack Benny program. And I walked in and I was a good reader and I aced the audition and boom, I'm in.
Did you get it? Did you understand what was that mean?
Oh my God, did I get it? This was like the answer to my dreams. I really didn't like the kid. I had a perfectly happy childhood, but I just thought the kid thing was kind of jive. So the idea of hanging out with not just grownups, but the seemingly like the hippest grownups in the world, the people at the Jack Benny show, it included Mel Blanc, who is the voice of all the Looney Tunes cartoon characters.
You are the new Mel Blanc, after all.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. But so it was just an amazing thing, and I dug every minute of it. I would be in regular public school half the time, and half the time off working either for Jack Benny or
what kind of sketches?
That's a bit like Gary. Gary went to a theater school. Gary was in lots of sort of children's films when he was a kid. Probably both unbearable.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I went to my first senior school and I took the first 6 weeks off with a chaperone to go and shoot a film. And God, boy, did the kids love me when I got back.
you're being facetious, of course. Right? I had kids in junior high, middle school here, who knew I was on TV and stuff and used to gather around me at lunchtime and say, ooh, that sandwich looks good. And my weapon of choice since I was younger and smaller than they were was to tell my mom. My mom made all sorts of different sandwiches for lunch. And one of the things she made, which was my favorite food from my earliest memory, was, hold on to your stomachs now, beef tongue. And so I said to her, for the moment, don't give me anything but beef tongue sandwiches. When the kids in school said, ooh, that looks good, what is that? I said, beef tongue. Whoa.
So the thing is, Harry, you're a pretty decent bass player, right?
I'm okay.
Yeah. So where did the music come? Was there a genuine love of music? I mean, was it always satirical or?
No, I mean, my dad, this is the kooky thing about me and Judith. Her dad was an opera singer. My dad was trained to be an opera singer, didn't get to actually perform because they had to flee Austria. But he was a trained operatic baritone. We went to classical music concerts all the time. They had a great record collection. I was deeply into music. When I was in high school, which was not a pleasant time for me, when I wasn't working, and I had to actually show up at high school, I had a soundtrack in my head of my favorite, then favorite music, which was Frank Sinatra with the Nelson Riddle Orchestra.
Oh, yeah, and the Riddle arrangements are the best.
Humming the arrangements, not even Sinatra's vocals, but the arrangements as I'd walk from class to class. So music was a very important part of my life.
You had everything for the kids to hate you. You had your showbiz success. You were humming Nelson Riddle arrangements.
I fit right in.
And eating beef tongue. But listen, I mean, maybe, is this what gave you the weapon of a sort of slant-eyed view of the world?
The outsider / insider. So I wanted to know everything about how the place worked because my parents didn't know. They were, as I say, immigrants. So it was my job to sort of figure out how this place that I had been born into worked. But yes, I think that is my stance, is outsider / insider. That is to say, an outsider socially who happens to know all this inside stuff.
Were magazines like Mad, were they like important in your life? Was that a good big influence?
Yeah, Mad was an influence. Certainly, I read every copy of it.
You sound like you were probably too grown up for that by the time you were.
Well, 10. I was too grown up. I was too grown up for Cracked.
Oh right,
just the right target audience for Mad. But the real influences were performers. Were, as I say, Pete and Dud. In this country, there was a satirist who did great parody versions of hit records called Stan Freeberg. And then he made his own amazing satirical album, an LP called Stan Freeberg Presents the United States of America, which was supposed to be the first in a series of records making fun of American history. It turned out to be only one of two, but it was wickedly funny and incredibly daring for its time. It had a lot of music in it. It was basically some sketches and a lot of songs with the Billy May Orchestra back then. Couldn't get Nelson Riddle, but he got Billy.
Right. And so would Tom Lehrer have featured?
Tom Lehrer, very much so. He had a record which was a 10-inch LP that came out from apparently nowhere. And there were these songs that were making fun of the Catholic Church and the Boy Scouts, and, you know, these supposedly untouchable marks. And then he got famous a little bit because the American version of That Was the Week That Was had him on doing a song every week on television. So for a while, he had a very successful career touring with very, for the time, as I say, transgressive material.
Yeah, his retirement was actually the greatest gag and greatest political trick anyone's ever pulled off.
Oh, I don't know that. What was it?
He basically retired when Kissinger got awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. He just said, I can't come up with anything as satirical as that ever. I quit. And he did.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, it wasn't a gag. He said, I can't go any further than this.
But I think people in the UK don't fully appreciate how much more dangerous it must have been in that sort of post-McCarthy period in America to be at all critical of the American dream and of the business of America. You know, it was kind of more accepted here and easy. You know, people, it wasn't as dangerous. I mean, did you sense that danger?
Well, not really. I started in 1968. There was a radio show that started up to make fun of the news, and I was part of the group. And we were on a big rock and roll station in Los Angeles. We didn't get syndicated outside of LA. But as far as LA was concerned, anything yeah. went. The only time we got in trouble, and this goes maybe to your point, the then vice president under Nixon, Spiro Agnew, was visiting a veterans hospital. Of course, this is right in the middle of the height of the Vietnam War. We did a sketch about him visiting a veterans hospital. And you heard in the background of the voices of Agnew and whoever he was meeting, the voices, the sounds of these veterans groaning in pain. And the manager of the station happened to hear that, you know, usually management didn't bother to listen, which was our saving grace. And he said, you have to now do a sketch making Spiro Agnew look good.
And who was groaning in pain then?
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. I took the chicken shit way out and said, I'm not doing that. And the other guys in the group, it's up to them to do that. And they did.
How in tune was what you were doing with satire, with the actual counterculture that was going on, all the music and everything? Was there an alignment there, or was everyone kind of plowing their own furrow?
Well, you know, we had a totally different job to do, which is to mm-hmm. make fun of something, of three somethings. We did three shows a day, every day, wow, which is a God. Very different task than, you know, writing a protest song once a month. So, we were trying to find what was funny in each day's news and didn't really care much. Mm-mm. I mean, we cared. We all knew the war sucked. I particularly, because I'd spent 6 years trying successfully avoiding it. But, you know, we had to take the stuff as it came. I'd put it that way. So our fire was aimed in a much broader array of targets.
Yeah. And sometimes it hit and sometimes it didn't, I guess. But you also, I mean,
how dare you? How dare you?
But I guess that if you're working that fast, you know.
Yeah, of course. I mean, we had a much better batting average in our third year. We were on another station in LA, radio station, and we had only one show a day to do. And I think that allowed us to do two things. More time to write and more time to produce stuff that really sounded good. I was really concentrating on the latter. I thought that we jumped the tracks from AM to FM, which in those days meant we had a better toolkit to work with in terms of audio effects and all that stuff. So I was really focusing on helping to make the shows just sound a lot better.
When did you find your voice, Harry, that you could do this? You had this skill?
Well, I think a couple months after I found my nose. No, just kidding. I was, my dad had a tape recorder, portable tape recorder, and I had some friends that I could induce into doing little radio shows with me. So probably that was the beginning of it. If you'd happened by the house and heard that stuff, this was before voices changed, you know, in terms of me and my friends. So they all sounded... Yeah. And I realized, I was thinking about this much later, imagining my parents hearing it in the other room and it all sounding the same to them, and realizing I wasn't training my voice at that age. I was training my ear, because in my head, I knew what they sounded like, and I had little compartments for each voice that I was trying to do. So it was a good self-training.
So I was waiting for you to say that you were mentored by Mel Blanc at the age of seven, and he taught you.
It never happened. It never came up.
Did you ever meet him?
Oh yeah,
yes, no, yeah.
He was on the Jack Benny show.
But did he take you? Did he was like, hey kid?
No.
I want that scene in the movie when they do your life, right, in the biopic.
I know it's going to happen.
He's like, hey kid, what is that? Beef tongue? Get out of here.
Yeah. He was just a lovely guy who took, you know, a fatherly, not a Catholic not in the Catholic sense, fatherly interest in me, because he had a son the same age, Noel, who ended up doing Mel's voices when Mel passed away, but never went, here's how you do Porky, here's how you do Bugs. No, none of that.
Years ago, I worked with Michael Jackson, but I never actually met him. He was in the room once, but he was hiding. But I got to, his producer was a good friend. He was hiding under the desk. We all had to pretend he wasn't there. We all knew he was there. But his producer Bill showed me, he had this thing which was a Walt Disney character mic, which is from the 30s, which is the thing they used to use for voice, and it had, and no one knew quite how it did it, but it's sort of caricature, whatever character you did, it made you more of a caricature. It had some weird thing with the ribbon in it or something.
I'm giving you my skeptical look.
Yes, because I know I was always, but you know, well, if they say it's the Disney character mic, then it's the Disney character mic, you know. So
yeah.
Then you ended on, and you did Saturday Night Live after that. Was that?
No, you hate. Well, you're on record as absolutely.
Oh, I loathed it.
Which is great, because there's this fantastic thing of this great mythical world of Saturday Night Live in the 70s. Oh my God, it's just man, there are all those people. But no, they hated it.
Yeah, it was. When you have a psychopathic boss, weird things happen.
Is that Law? Are we talking about Lorne Michaels here?
Oh, yeah. We might be, yeah.
What was it like then? So to explain some of that.
Well, I was a pro. I, you know, done this business as a child. I then came back. I had just produced a pilot for a comedy show for ABC where Spinal Tap first originated. So I kind of knew the ropes. And Lorne's main approach in those days was to hire people who pretty much had never been on TV before. This was their big break, and therefore
Second City a lot, wasn't it?
But therefore you could get away with murder, because they didn't know what was regular television stuff and what was the fever dreams of a psychopath.
That's the title of my autobiography. How did you know?
Yeah. So, you know, for an example, this was something that I was really aware of, because right about this was right about the time that of the 700 people suiciding at Jonestown.
Oh, Jonestown.
And we were reading a lot about how Jim Jones ran the place. And one of the key things that he did was to fuck with people's body clocks. And that's exactly what was happening at SNL. Every day was on a different clock. So by the end of the week, you'd had a day that started at 7 in the evening. You'd had a day that started at 2 in the morning. You'd had a day that started at 10 in the morning. I mean, so by the end of the week, you had kind of lost contact with Earth. It was in those days, I think it's well known, very druggy. And not a good drug. And so many of the ways of the, I actually read a book about a show that was almost exactly that same show, but was done in the 50s. It was called Your Show of Shows, and it was on in prime time, but it was sketches, musical act, hour and a half live from the same frigging studio. And it started the week with the writers coming in on Monday morning and writing the show on Monday. And then the actors had 4 or 5 days to rehearse it. And at SNL, it was run more like a college dorm. Nobody was really encouraged. People were discouraged from coming in to start writing until middle of the night, Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, which left no time for rehearsal. And so people were just reading cue cards.
But what would be the point of that, other than to just disorient? Are you saying it was a cult?
The point of that would be, so everything was moved later in the week. So it didn't really leave a lot of time for people. People were scrambling. Didn't leave a lot of time for people to disagree with the producer or say, how come this sketch isn't in? Or why are we doing this? You just had to head down and scramble. So it was, if you were the producer, it was a much more comfy way of running a show.
So who was in that writing room with you?
The first time around, because I went to that show
two times,
just proving that smart people can be really stupid. Christopher Guest, Billy Crystal, Martin Short.
That's right. You did Fernwood Tonight, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Which I saw the first time I went to America, which I thought was the funniest thing ever, almost live and nearly from Hollywood.
Yeah.
That was, I love that. Power Tennis for the Blind. Brilliant.
Yeah, that was the first time I think a lot of Americans were exposed not only to Martin Mull, but to the late, great Fred Willard, who was just most astonishing. you know, I know a lot of people in comedy. I understand a lot about many of them. I could never figure out Fred Willard. He was like on a comedy wavelength from Mars. It was just so remarkable and and so, you know, that I was in a movie with him, a Christopher Guest movie, and we were in a scene together. Fred was going to interview, Fred's character was going to interview my character. And the only piece of direction I ever got from Christopher as he's walking me to the chair where I'm going to sit and be interviewed by Fred, we're walking there, he puts his arm around my shoulder and he says three words, don't even try.
What movie was this?
This was For Your Consideration.
Oh, right, right.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Hang on, Fred Willard, I'm making sure I'm thinking of the right guy. He's on the Air Force base in Spinal Tap. Yes. Yeah. Getting a little long there myself. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no, he's a, yes, he's.
And he was Martin Mull's sidekick on.
That's right, yeah.
And I would be in there every day, kind of being a little bit critical of some of what was being written by others. And then I'd hear Fred take that material and make it pure comedy gold.
Like Best in Show. I mean, performance, I mean, why?
Yeah.
And are you in those writing rooms for, you know, explaining to people who have never been in one, including myself? do you bring in
the room where it happens?
Do all of you bring in a piece and say, let's work on this, I've got an idea, or just some things get improvised and battered around immediately? I mean, and what's your role in there? Where are you comfortable?
I'm the typist.
It's funny it's funny you say that though, because when I tried writing comedy, I remember Ian Lefrené, British comedy, right, said to me, "Are you the writer or the pacer?" because apparently, like, all comedy partnerships, there's the guy who types and there's the guy who paces.
Yeah, well,
are you a typer or a pacer?
I'm definitely a typer. I've known comedy teams like that. I would write when Christopher and Marty would write together, which happened a lot in that show. I think everybody was sitting, but I've always been the typist because it's the one thing I learned in high school was how to touch type really fast. So, you know, a typist who doesn't slow down the flow of ideas is...
Yeah, that's priceless, yeah.
It is priceless. It does give you a bit of control because, you know, you'll hear things and then other things you won't hear, you know.
You suggest a gag and they go, no, do this one. And you just put your one in because you're the one writing it down.
Yeah, I wouldn't be like that. But you know.
I mean, you're chucking in ideas, though, I take it.
Well, yeah, I mean, in answer to your question, we wouldn't come in with stuff already to work on. It would always be, it's a quarter after midnight. What the fuck should we do? Sort of like that.
And so is it here that the beast was born?
Well, Michael wasn't there, but Christopher was. That Tap was born on this pilot that we had done before I went to Saturday Night Live, which was a pilot for ABC. And it was called The TV Show. And it was basically you start the show behind a guy who's sitting in a lounge chair with a remote and a big TV in front of him, and you're watching what he's watching. And that was the format of, and it's an hour long sketch show making fun of whatever is on TV.
And did this guy actually have to sit there for the hour?
He did his stuff and then left. That guy was Rob Reiner, who was the
right.
So go and explain how this first idea, because look, you're the only person who's not in a rock band officially, as it were, Harry, that we've had on this show. So you've got to pay.
Apart from Ian Lefrené, we've had one other great comedy.
Ian was in a rock band?
No, he was on our show.
Ian was even further away from rock music than you are, but he's what you're the, so you've got to pay your dues here. And we've got to talk about being in a rock band, especially fantastic band. What was
I have so much to say, and I have so much to accuse you of. But
what was the first germ of the idea? Whose was it?
We were doing this TV show, and one of the things that was on TV that we were making fun of was a late night music show called Midnight Special, which was hosted by this rock DJ called Wolfman Jack.
Yeah.
And Rob really good Wolfman Jack, and he didn't play an instrument, so he was Wolfman Jack. And so we just had to create a band to perform in that parody of Midnight Special. And Michael still has the little piece of paper where we were figuring out what the name of the band would be. And then we wrote a song called Rock and Roll Nightmare. And in that era of Midnight Special, bands would perform live, but they would also create these little proto videos. It was before actual videos were out, but they, while they were on this show, they'd create some kind of video to go with their song. So they'd be performing live and then they'd dissolve to this video. So we did a video for Rock and Roll Nightmare. And at the end, it was supposed to be smoke coming down, and it was a camera above us. We were on the floor, and the prop guy screwed up, and the smoke was coming down as hot liquid oil. And to distract ourselves from killing the prop man, we started talking about what else should we do with this band? What should we do? Maybe we should do more with this band, and thought of this idea. And then we thought, okay, that's a band, but the movie is about kind of a backstage view. So it's like about the roadies. And then we went together and saw a movie called Roadie. And we started going to a lot of concerts. I think we went, the first one was Judas Priest at Long Beach Arena, which is the first time.
Makes sense.
That. Yeah. And that was the first time I felt that, the kick drum in my chest. And we sat down, we got a deal to write a first draft screenplay from this British company, Marble Arch, Sir Lou Grade, or as I guess it was known in those days, Sir Low Grade. And we got into a hotel room and wrote for 3 days. I was the typist. And then we looked at each other and said, nobody is going to understand this, because we were writing as if it was that movie. And it's just the documentary style and just everything just didn't read right. So we said to each other, this is not a lot of money. Let's just take this money and make a demo, draw them a picture so they can understand what this is. So we made a 20-minute demo, which some people have seen. A lot of the jokes and most of the songs squeezed in, you know. And we went to every movie major studio in Hollywood, because Rob was a celebrity, he could get us in, and showed them this 20-minute demo. And when the lights came up, it was the same every time. What was that? Well, that was a demo for a feature. Oh, rock and roll movies don't make money. So they had no clue. And we were extremely discouraged until a friend of Rob's, as it turned out, a guy he'd worked for on All in the Family, which was the American version.
Alf Garnett.
Alf Garnett, yeah. Till Death.
Till Death, the First DuPont, yeah.
Yeah. And Rob sent it to Norman Lear, that is the name of the guy. And he greenlit the project. That's the only reason the movie ever got made. And we decided we wouldn't write a script because we wanted it to really feel like a documentary. So it wasn't because we all wanted to do improv. I had never done improv in my life. I'm a writer. But we thought that was the technique that would make the movie feel incredibly real. So every word of that movie is improvised, except for Dennis Eaton Hogg's toast, because Patrick didn't improvise. So he said, write me a toast. Otherwise, everybody was improvising.
It's the comedy equivalent of like the first Velvet Underground album, where they said, you know, only 300 people bought it, but they all started bands. Every musician has seen that. You've destroyed our business. It's impossible for any of us to take ourselves seriously anymore. The last tour I did with Pink Floyd, which is a long time ago now, I actually carried a yellow card around with me, because every time someone made a fucking Tap reference, I got the card out. I was so sick and tired of it. I can probably count on one hand the amount of times since that film came out that I've walked from a dressing room to a stage and someone hasn't said, "Woo, Cleveland."
Yeah.
So you've destroyed everything. You actually did what the Sex Pistols were meant to do. You killed rock and roll.
But Guy, you and I played in Cleveland 2 years ago, and on the wall as you go to the gig, it's right, "Hello Cleveland" written on.
But actually, on that film, I was told that apparently that was based on a true story. That was a Roxy Music story.
It was a bunch of things. I was in New York. An old friend of mine was the manager of the Grateful Dead, and they were playing Madison Square Garden, and he invited me to come down to see him. And Madison Square Garden, as you may know, has two venues in it. And I'm walking around trying to find the backstage door, And I'm walking around and I'm walking around and I finally open a door and it's the door to the other venue where there's a light heavyweight fight in progress. And so that was at least one of the germs of that idea. But to your point, we got punished for that because we have never, I don't think we've ever even been nominated the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but the gift shop at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame sells Hello Cleveland t-shirts.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Where the beauty of it is, and all the detail of the Englishness of the names, you know,
and the history, all that stuff.
Getting the evolution of that band in all of the right pop culture moments. I mean, you guys must have been Anglophiles, and maybe a lot of that did get missed when you were showing it to American producers. So, because to us, that was what was so detailed and funny.
Good point. I mean, Christopher's dad was English, so he was an Anglophile by birth. He was a labor lord.
He's a lord, that's right, yes.
Yeah. But, and Michael and I were just, you know, I think one of the first things we talked about when we first were introduced was the remarkable fact that we both possessed a copy of a record by Stanley Holloway.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Brown, wow. Shoes. Yeah.
Brown Shoes.
And he had done a record here of English music hall songs. And we both had it. We both had memorized the songs, you know. And you could do a lot of things at the seaside that you can't do in town. Stuff like that.
I love that.
Yeah.
Brown Shoes. Listen out for that one. It's a particular favorite of mine.
Okay. Will do. But so, and we thought... The other thing was Christopher had done on a project called National Lampoon Radio Hour. He had done the Nigel character. So he wanted to bring that character along with him. And so we all thought, okay, well, we'll be Brits. And I think it made it funnier to us, partly because we didn't know. I was going to make something up. We just thought that was funnier, you know.
I don't know if certainly from that period, if there were American bands you could really lampoon.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
But British is funny, you know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think also because, you know, we take our pop music extremely seriously. You know, it's connected to our pop culture, it's connected to youth culture, it's connected to, you know, there are. You know, this is the new art form and we're sort of inventing it over in Britain. Mm-hmm, and I think that seriousness was ready to be pricked, wasn't it?
But having said that, self-deprecation is built, especially into British comedy, in a way that it isn't in American, isn't it?
Yeah, but they weren't deprecating themselves.
No, that's true. Yeah, no, they were completely
deprecated by us. But
I think in a way it's done us all a favor because maybe since then, you know, if any British band or any member of a band starts to step out of line, the parody becomes very obvious and they're soon hauled back in.
It's a sort of Damocles over everybody's head. I should add that it's not just rockers who do tap references. I get stopped by country artists and even by classical musicians who say, that's what we've got on our bus.
Yeah, but well, funny, I saw a thing recently that there's like an hour of extra footage or footage that didn't make the film. Mm-hmm. The only thing I think is a real shame is such a lovely guy was the support band with what's her name from The Runaways?
Oh, Sherry Curry. Yeah,
Sherry Curry. I mean, that's an amazing storyline.
It is, and you know, when you make a movie, at least when you make a comedy, I don't know anything about. All I know about drama is you can get away with a shot that's 20 seconds long of a dewdrop on a leaf and nobody says, get on with it. You have to create a lot of stuff that you love that you then have to kill for the sake of the shape of the piece and the pace of the piece. And I mean, that whole, there was a day when we just realized, because we tried it, we tried a cut of the movie without, we loved that storyline. There was one day we tried a cut of the movie without it and showed it to some people. And they laughed at the sores without knowing where the sores came from. And we thought,
oh, man, but the sores, you know, the cold sores, that was the biggest fear I had touring. And still to this day, although they seem to not to get in my way too much now. But in the 80s, you know, I was exhausted in the 80s. And my brother and I, you know, my brother's an extremely good looking man. The last thing he wants is a great big black mark on his lip. We used to get them sort of, you know, every tour. And they would when I saw that you'd actually even picked up on that. You know, I just the detail was extraordinary.
Where that comes from, Gary, is the storyline, because they've got this girl, the singer, in this support band, and one by one they all get cold sores.
And the band that they were, the all girl band, was called The Dose. we loved Sherry.
And you had all that press conference. So there was the 1960s press conference as well.
Yeah,
just fabulous.
But when we realized that the sores would get laughs and didn't need that whole backstory, we realized you have to cut it.
Yeah,
I the first time, I don't know what the first time, I'm sure you remember the first time you saw it, Guy, but the first time I saw it was in 1985 on a VHS, and it was in Ireland, and it was Joe Elliott had it from Def Leppard. So he'd never seen it before. So my band, Spandau Ballet, are sitting down with Def Leppard, and we watch this program. And I think I was getting more of the gags than Joe and Def Leppard were. I think there were moments of like, but this is just normal, right?
Well, someone
told me, I'm not going to mention any names, but a record producer told me that he was on a tour bus with a big 70s band in the early, and who were doing a tour which had just been downgraded from arenas to theatres as they were going. And someone put that on the tour bus and no one laughed.
Well, I think one of the brothers in Oasis had that same experience with the film. I believe he actually walked out on it. Liam.
He walks out on a lot of things, Liam.
He only walks in so he can walk out.
Was there a moment? But is there a moment in your life? Because you are doing a lot of parody in your life. Here you are. You can actually play. You've toured Spinal Tap. Mm-hmm. Is there ever a bit of you that thinks, but I wish I could just go out and do something seriously with a band? Or have you done, is being serious is something you just can't perform with?
I've done serious acting. I was in a play in London and in the provinces a couple of years ago, which had one laugh.
I take it back.
Oh, that's all right.
But as a musician.
Huh? Yeah, no, I know what you mean. But no, I don't have any musical ideas that aren't based in. Well, I'll take that back.
Well, you wrote a musical, didn't you?
Huh?
You wrote a musical, did you not?
I written a musical, but I didn't write the music for it. But I did an album. I did four albums as myself singing songs that I wrote, but they were all satirical songs. I did an album singing a bunch of songs as Donald Trump, as a matter of fact. The last record that I did as myself, I did write two non-funny songs. And it's the first time I did anything like that. And one of the songs was an ode. I sort of channeled nobody will get this reference, but I channeled my inner Hoagie Carmichael to write an anthem about when autumn comes to New Orleans. Because, you know, summer is so long and so by the end of it, so painful that that first day of autumn is a remarkable thing. And I thought, Well, there's been an autumn in New York, but there's never been an autumn in New Orleans. So,
but New Orleans is important to you as well, isn't it?
I live here. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you did a documentary, didn't you, about?
I did, about the why the city flooded. So I you know, I don't try to write New Orleans style music. So as I say, Hoagie Carmichael, who was a Southerner who attained success, I sort of kind of channeled that feeling a little bit. And then I wrote a song just because I'd been saying this for so many years to explain why I hate cold weather. And and it became the chorus of the song. Heat is only skin deep, but cold is to the bone. And so,
I
find the heat and humidity of New Orleans, I love New Orleans. I adore it. But I find the heat and the humidity nigh unbearable.
Well, we have a thing now called air conditioning, mate.
Yeah. I mean, we've got to get onto the Simpsons at some point as well. But I just wanted to finish off on tap and just because it wasn't a big hit at first, was it? It was a slow burner. And was there a great disappointment in with you guys after all the work?
It was. We had as at our backs, a film company, which was in the process of a long, slow slide toward bankruptcy and really couldn't support us at all and really didn't know how to promote the film. The first ad they suggested, there was a hit film at the time called Airplane. And the visual for that ad was an airplane whose fuselage was tied
in a knot. Yeah.
And the geniuses at our film company suggested to us an ad where the neck of a guitar was tied into a knot. We said, no, you can't do that. You can't suggest it's the same kind of comedy as Airplane or not.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, okay. So they really kind of gave up on promoting it at all. And then to our dismay, the cover of the VHS was a guitar neck tied in a knot. And so we really got, we were doing okay, but there are aspects of the film business that we learned a lot about when we got kicked out of theaters, even though we were doing okay. So I think we were the first non-porn home video to really catch on. And that's what saved our bacon, was that home video was just coming along and people could, the wildfire that happened in that format.
Every sensible home had Spinal Tap and Debbie Does Dallas, right? Have you been recording Simpsons during the pandemic? Is that all still going on?
Yeah. I was fortunate enough to be one of the people who was working all through the pandemic. For 31 years, I was saying to them, you know, I have a studio in my house. You could let me record there. And, oh, no, you have to come in. We have special microphones and another special thing.
Yeah, character mics.
March of last year, please record in your house. And here's the microphone.
So, but before, wasn't The Simpsons, the idea was that you were in the same room as, listen, it's impossible. It's not like you're in the same room as other actors playing other characters. You're playing about six characters. You're having a conversation with yourself during recording, aren't you?
Because you do Burns and Smithers. Apparently you do that. You can do that in real time.
As a regular conversation, yeah. Wow. Yeah, I mean, we were in the same room until, you know, everybody or a lot of us got busy and couldn't be there all at the same time. So,
And the Fox or Disney is now, or whatever it is, do they have sort of contracts with you saying you can't do the voice on any other channel or in any other format? Those voices, that's, you know, it's...
I have not read such a clause, if it exists in our contract. I think somewhere it says that they own them, but I don't know.
So would it be incredibly awful of us to ask for a quick burst or something?
You, sir... stepping over your bounds. Release the hounds.
Yay!
Oh. Okay, yeah, we've just sent the bank details. Yeah. But I hear that one particular upsets your throat. You can't do it for too long, right?
No, only it got rough when we were doing the video games, and it would just be me alone in a room for 4 hours, and the only direction I'd get from the producer was louder. and that starts to hurt after a while.
Were you part of the show when it went back? Because I seem to remember the beginning being in the early 90s, or was it when with Tracy Ullman?
Yeah.
It was part of the Tracy Ullman.
That's right. Yeah, it was a segment. Yeah, were you on it then? That's right. It was a
I was in it until it became its own show. I had, and this is one of the peculiarities of, I guess, this thing called life, I was called to do the 2-minute segment in the Tracy Ullman show and they wanted me to do something as myself. And at the time, I was really like, had my head up my ass about, well, I only do characters. It was really just because I didn't feel comfortable on camera as myself. I didn't know how to play me. So we went around on that a couple of times. And then I just said, nah, I don't think this worked. And the next person they called, I guess, was Matt. So, and then he called through an intermediary me when the show was going to a full show. So it's peculiar how all that happened.
That's interesting. So what you're saying, so this was the first time you've ever done a voice that wasn't a person who existed, if you know what I mean.
I'm just thinking if that's true. I've played characters on screen that didn't exist.
That's true. Yeah.
I always had somebody in mind to be. So I did a guest shot on Miami Vice, and I had an idea in my head of who I was doing. It wasn't a famous person, but it was. I've always had a model, mainly, except for that play. That was somebody I did out of whole cloth.
Sorry. So in that case, so who is Derek Smalls?
Derek Smalls was just every British rocker that I heard in my head kind of smushed together.
And did they give you one character, or did they immediately say you've got six characters, get on with it?
I think Matt was a fan of my radio show and he knew I did a bunch of characters. So I think the whole premise of me being there was from the top, I was going to be doing a bunch of characters. I don't remember how many in the first script, but it was clearly, it was a multi-character gig.
I don't know whether you want to talk about this anyway, but I know you've just lost Dr. Hibbert. You're no longer doing Dr. Hibbert. That's okay with you, I guess. That's a tough one to talk about, really.
It's been an interesting experience to hear one's character be done by somebody else. I guess Mel Blanc didn't have to do that. Didn't have to, wasn't around to hear the new Porky, or the improved Bugs. But all I ever say about that is it is the actor's job to play somebody that they're not.
Yeah. Although I still can't get over it, and I only actually found this out because to be honest, I haven't watched The Simpsons for a while. I mean, I devoured it for years. Mm-hmm. But then, because I just got worried, you just think it can't keep being funny, surely. But I've only just recently found out this thing of Principal Skinner turning out to be an imposter.
That was an episode in season 12. I inveighed fairly dramatically against that. I said, we've got the audience knowing this character for 12 years, and now we're telling the audience, screw you. You fell for something and it's not true. And, you know, I thought it was rude to the audience to do that.
No, I agree. Because I loved his whole background, the whole Nam thing.
Yeah.
Thin gruel with four kinds of rice that he was forced to live on.
And it's now sort of a ghost episode. Nobody talks about it.
And you write?
Yeah. Sorry.
Do you write any of that?
TV is a writer's medium. They don't want you to improvise there.
Right.
I did about 3 or 4 years ago write one episode, but I'm not a fan of the process. You know, I'm at a point in my life where I think I'm a pretty good writer, and I don't like my stuff being run through a room full of 16 writers, so I have to get a joke in. So
I have to say, from my point of view, the importance of The Simpsons is, I mean, my youngest child, the first time he ever heard one of my songs was actually in The Simpsons. So he's forever associated it with comedy, which isn't uncommon, probably.
Yeah.
And also, my eldest child, who's seen it all, seen all of them, you know, he would sit and have dinner with us when he was a small kid, and he'd come up with the most profound statements, politically, scientifically, philosophically, and everyone would turn and say, where did you get that? The Simpsons.
Yeah, yeah. It is an educational show in a lot of ways.
we can't keep you all night. And what's frustrating is that your diversity is incredible. You know, you've had an art exhibition, you know.
Yeah.
Documentaries and books and but I particularly wanted to just talk about quickly the Richard Nixon series that you've done, because what the premise is that they're all found tapes. Is it true?
Well, the tape recordings, the dialogue, the conversations are all from the collection of tapes that Richard Nixon ran on himself.
They're hysterical.
Yeah. And my co-writer on that project was a history professor at University of Wisconsin, who had to file a lawsuit to get access to the tapes. Nixon and his family were claiming that they owned the tapes. And my partner, Stanley, claimed accurately that they were recorded on government tape machines managed by members of the United States Navy and stored in government warehouses. And therefore, we, the American public, owned them, and he prevailed. Nixon was running tape on himself because he thought this would, when in his later years, when he was doing his memoirs, he would use them as reference points. He never dreamed they'd be made public. And I used to go whenever I would go to Washington, which I did a lot because I have a, my godson lives there. I'd go listen to the tapes. I'd put on crappy little library headphones and listen to these conversations. And so the premise of the TV show was, although we couldn't say it, but it was the way it looked and the way it felt, is that he'd hidden cameras in the White House as well as microphones. And we rehearsed the shit out of these conversations because I was determined that we had this great gift from Nixon, a monster in every way as much as Trump was. And we had to pay due respect to this gift by getting it absolutely right. And so the conversations were, you know, the rhythms were right. When people talked over each other or the pauses, that was all right. And the crew made a 360 degree set of Richard Nixon's Oval Office. So when you walked in, you didn't see cameras, you didn't see lights. And it was amazing to see the effect that had on the other actors as they walked into that set and really walked into that world. It really changed them.
And the combination of sycophancy and stupidity is so mind-blowing.
Well, it's an elegant recipe. And Kissinger, Henry Kissinger, the Nobel Peace Prize winner.
Played by Henry Goodman.
Played by Henry Goodman.
Right, right.
Kissinger was maybe for all time the sycophant of sycophants. He and Nixon kind of loathed each other. Nixon loathed what Kissinger was, which was a Harvard professor and a Jew, and Kissinger loathed Nixon for being not Kissinger. And it was so much fun to do that. Such hard work, 4 hours of makeup, but killer fun.
But it's also, that's funny what you said, because it's always this thing of how Nixon had those tapes and he had cameras and machine, and he was recording everything. And it goes back to exactly what you've been talking about, which is Biden probably just has Alexa.
Yeah, I do wonder about that, if they if they allow Alexa or any of those, or even Siri in the White House. I hope not. I was on a road trip once where we asked Siri to we spoke dirty to Siri and saw what happened there. The people at Apple did anticipate that would happen, I have to say.
Oh yeah, I'm sure they did.
Harry, thank you so much. Yeah. For coming on. I feel bad that we didn't speak about half the things you've done in your life, because there's so many.
Well, I'm writing my memoir, so you'll get that.
And your website is fantastic. Anyone who wants to know more about you should just go there, right?
Thank you. And I have to say, your biggest hit, I guess, was ubiquitous when I was in England doing my research just before we shot the movie. I went on the road with Saxon. And when I came back to London, I was walking around, checking stuff out, checking what football jersey to what football team to be a supporter, what Derek would be a supporter of. And I that song was ubiquitous.
Maybe I've got you to thank that it's been in The Simpsons 3 times.
I guess.
That's just too much information there, isn't there, with him?
Listen, I'm sure some of our listeners would be happy if we just spoke Spinal Tap for an hour.
Do you know what? The funny thing is, I had all these Spinal Tap things I wanted to say, and then I kind of forgot most of them. But also because there's just so much else you want to talk about.
You know, he has a lot that's gone on in his life other than Spinal Tap, you know. But it's still one of the greatest rock movies ever made, and I think that's certainly a good enough excuse to get him on the show.
No, absolutely. No, we're all doomed to walk in its shadow forever.
Anyway, thank you for listening. Just to say how much we like the feedback we get from you on Twitter and Instagram and in any other way you give us feedback behind our backs. And so we'll see you next week. And it's good night from me.
And it's good night from me.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.